Anyway, so I want to, well, so first I want to join the other speakers in thanking the organizers putting together a stimulating conference. Very broad. I normally don't go to high energy physics conferences, even when the focus on low energy physics, but so it's a little bit of a challenge. I don't know what the backgrounds are. I'll bore people like Subir and my other condensed matter colleagues, but and anyway, I want to tell you a story about a relation between certain kind of a somewhat exotic gauge theories, description of this new state of matter, fracton state of matter, and conventional elasticity. And this work was done with a very talented postdoc, Michael Pretko, that came out of Senthil's group at MIT, and we're very fortunate to have him in Boulder for the past year and a half. So if you don't catch something, it was in the archive in 2007, and it's now in PRL, things that I'm going to talk about. Let's see what I do with that pointer. Okay. So yeah, so let me start out with an outline. So I'll talk about a certain kind of a new type of a spin liquid that is fracton phase of matter. There's various descriptions and different types of fracton matter, models that exhibit fracton behavior, but I'll describe it in terms of higher rank gauge theories. Then I'll remind you about standard elasticity and then demonstrate that these two, the punchline of the talk, of this work, is that there's a duality between these higher rank gauge theory description of this fracton matter and standard elasticity, and thereby, by extension, also sort of linear gravity, quantum gravity, being basically the same as elasticity. So I'll talk about that duality, and it kind of demystifies these fracton gauge theories or fracton matter in terms of something very familiar to us, at least something that I work on often is elasticity. So let me first start out in the beginning, in a sense. So most states of matter that are familiar to us are conventional order states of matter, antiferromagnets, superfluids, etc., are characterized in terms of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So there's usually a local order parameter, a Landau order parameter, and Landau taught us how to describe it. We think about construct a Landau functional, think about symmetry based on symmetries that are in the disordered phase, symmetries in the ordered phase. So it's a very simple, by now very well-known description, so-called Landau description in terms of a local order parameter. It's very simple. But sort of the frontier of condensed matter physics, theoretical condensed matter physics, is to look beyond at systems in which this kind of a description fails. There's no local order parameter that characterizes, distinguishes phases. There's something non-trivial and something ordered about a phase, but there's not a simple local order parameter. So because these phases are on the face of it, are disordered, so locally they just look like disordered matter, although there's some underlying order, they're usually referred to as liquids. So the conventional, and I put in conventional in quotes, before fractons, these were the exotic states of matter, they still are, and you heard a little bit about them, some examples of them yesterday. So conventional quantum liquids are, you know, some examples of it, quantum Hall systems, various kind of magnetic, frustrated magnetic systems. Toric code is an example of it that was related to talks yesterday. So here's an example of a toric code, a model which has basically two commuting projectors. One is the star operator that's a product of sigma z operators touching a site. And a sum over Plaquette terms of sigma x's around the Plaquette. There's a three-dimensional versions of that described in spin ice. So there's many, many models now that exhibit the spin liquid order. Much of attention experimentally is to try to find realizations in physical systems. But there are now it's very clear. There's many, many models that exhibit this exotic quantum spin liquid behavior. So Some of the features of it is they're non-local. There's some non-local characterization of these phases. There's fractionalized excitations. Excitations carry quantum numbers that are not there in the microscopic descriptions. And these excitations are typically ends of strings. So there's some kind of a string-like description, and the ends of strings are these fractionalized excitations. They typically are anionic rather than just bosons and fermions. But they're, because they're ends of a string, they're free to move. You simply just extend the string by one lattice constant, and you move, and those particles can move. And this so here's an example of a toric code where there's electrical charges E, two electrical particles, and they're connected by a string. So that's a defect in this kind of a constraint, Coulomb's law constraint, Z2 Coulomb's law constraint. Then there's magnetic excitations. For example, here's a plaquette of sigma x's, but one the red bond is where sigma x takes a value of minus one. So then there's a this plaquette has a is this constraint of all the plaquettes having a product of sigma x's being plus one is violated. So you have a magnetic excitation here, and they're connected by a string. Two magnetic excitations connected by a string. So typically these theories have topological order. And there's along with that comes ground state degeneracy. So if you're in a non-trivial manifold, there's a ground state degeneracy. Typically, it's of order one. It's related to the sort of a genus of the surface that you look at. These systems tend to be long-range entangled, and they usually admit a gauge theory description, Z2 gauge theory, or U1 gauge theory, or other more exotic gauge theory description, but it's sort of a vector-like. These are the standard gauge theories that capture these phases of matter. So just a little bit more on this. So you start out with some kind of a spin model. Let's say this is an example of spin ice, and what emerges at low energies once you encode the constraints is that there's some kind of the phase of matter is some kind of a condensate, string condensate. So strings lose their line tension, and as a result, these particles, the ends of the strings, are no longer, you know, confined by the string tension, and so they get liberated, and so that's a deconfined phase of this frustrated magnet, and it's described by some kind of a Coulomb phase of some emergent electrodynamics. So literally, you can start with a microscopic lattice model of spins, and what comes out at low energies is some kind of electromagnetism. That's a U1 electromagnetism. So it's very beautiful, and it's been very extensively explored. And again, the holy grail is to find this in physical systems, experimentally find it in physical systems. But more recently, there's been a new class of quantum liquids that doesn't seem to fall under this simple description of conventional quantum spin liquids. So this new class is what I want to talk about, this new class of quantum matter, quantum liquids. It got dubbed the name of fracton matter. So there's in retrospect, the history goes back to Chomon in 2005. And then there's, you know, a series of works that have, you know, elucidated and uncovered and rediscovered various fracton models. There's a number of models, lattice models. It's basically multi-spin-like interaction models, lattice models. So like this one is a model of the simplest one that I can understand is the X-cube model, where there are 12 spin interaction. Basically, spins live on, Ising spins, quantum spins live on the bonds of a cubic lattice. And there are terms which is a product of 12, let's say, sigma x's around this cube, and then there's a product of sigma y's for each face touching a vertex. I don't want to get into these lattice models. just this is just to give you some flavor of it. They kind of have a flavor, you know, quite similar to the Tory code-like systems, except they're in three dimensions, higher dimensions, and they're somewhat more involved. So because my focus will be on the gauge theory description, the continuum description, I don't want to belabor the get into the details of the lattice models, but suffice it to say that they admit excitations, and those excitations, indicated here in blue, where you flip spins, but the excitations are, you cannot create just one excitation. You create, for example, here, a quartet of excitations, and those excitations, rather than being on the ends of strings, like in the ordinary gauge theories, they're like in this example, they appear at the corners of some kind of a membrane. And so they're very non-local, so you cannot create one or even two of them. And because they're not at the end of the strings, these excitations, the kind of the most important feature of it, is there are some excitations that are completely immobile. So you have translational invariance in the system, but nevertheless, excitations cannot move. And that's very attractive from the point of view of quantum information and memory and things. Sometimes these excitations are here in the X cube model, the excitations are at the corners of this membrane. But in the Haas code that was very famous model that Haas introduced, these excitations, these black objects, the black dots appear on the fractal object. So this is a somewhat more complicated model to understand than this nice X cube model. So again, so the kind of the most important feature to take away that these systems exhibit is that they have non-local fractionalized excitations, and these excitations appear at corners of extended objects. These are the fractons, and they're completely immobile in isolation. If you just have in vacuum, you create these excitations, they cannot move. If you have background of them, like finite density, then they can move. One excitation can move as a result of the finite density of other excitations. So that's the SLA feature. Sometimes there are other excitations that are not fractons, but they're dipoles of fractons, like here. Those guys can move, but they're still constrained. They move in a constrained way. They are subdimensional, so they can move in certain directions, but not in others. Like they're confined in this X cube model. These guys are confined to a plane. So I heard about these. I was visiting actually KITP. I was on sabbatical there, and I remember Senthil was telling me about this, and I read a little bit about it. But it was at that point the only thing that existed is this Ha code, and I didn't really. It was quite a bit more complicated. I didn't want to. I felt like this is a really abstract and complicated something. I was having a difficult time understanding. But these two features of it, this immobile excitations and the subdimensional particles, really captured my imagination. And I very quickly realized that it's actually something that's I've heard before, something that I've worked on before, and that's topological defects in elasticity theory. It's kind of just clicked. The main features of it, independent of the details of the models. And so let me now tell you about this connection to topological defects. So if you have a crystal, in a crystal you can create various types of topological defects. Two main ones are, the most fundamental one is a disclination. So if you, one way to think of it is you cut out a wedge out to infinity at some point, and then glue this together onto this. So now you have this missing wedge of atoms, and so that the end point of that defect is a disclination. So I don't think it's very well known, and in fact I didn't appreciate this until I started thinking about this problem, that disclinations are actually immobile. So if you think about this in retrospect, it's actually quite obvious. You know, if you take a piece of paper, you tear out this, cut out this wedge, glue it together. If you try to move that point, you really cannot move it. Okay, if you want to move it by one lattice constant, you have to tear it again, cut out another wedge, do something very non-local, and then re-glue it together. And one way to see that is this disclination is actually can be understood as an array of dislocations. that I will talk about in a second, but dislocation is a half ray of atoms. So if you construct a, if you create a ray, an infinite ray of dislocations, these objects in blue, starting at this red point, that is equivalent to having a disclination. But this, these blue dislocations, defects, are actually half rays of atoms. So if you wanted to move a disclination, one lattice constant, you actually have to add a whole row, an infinite ray of atoms. You have to add one more dislocation. And that's a very non-local process. So in the local Hamiltonian, you're not going to have that operator. And that's why this disclination cannot hop. Okay? So it's kind of funny. Once you kind of understand this, it's kind of embarrassingly trivial to talk about this. It's as often with these things that sometimes you start out with something that's very complicated, but then once you understand it, it becomes very simple, as I hope you will see at the end of this talk. So yeah, so that's one sort of a connection that I appreciated right away, hearing about these mysterious fracton phases. The other is the other feature is dislocation. So here's a dislocation. It's kept, it's a vector defect. So it's physically it's just a half ray of atoms that's inserted into a crystal. That's a local defect where it's located this blue point. And it's a vector defect. It's and that vector points in the direction of, well, as indicated here, that's a Burgers vector that describes the vector nature of that defect. It's located at this point, but the Burgers vector tells you which ray of atom or you know perpendicular to the ray of, to the ray of atoms that's being inserted. So, well, one way, mathematical way to characterize it, if you go around a dislocation and into a, in the if you make a loop around a dislocation, you'll get a displacement. You'll get a non-trivial circulation of displacement, gradients of displacement, which will equal to exactly this Burgers vector. And you can just count. Take three steps this way, three steps this way, three steps this way, and three steps that way, and you will be displaced from the original position by a Burgers vector. Okay, so if you think about it, this dislocation, if you want to move this dislocation, it cannot climb. It cannot go up. In order for this blue circle to move up, you need to lose an atom. And so if you have a conservation of atoms, you don't have any vacant interstitials around, you can't move. You really cannot move. But if you have a vacancy like this, then this guy can move. This guy can, this end of this dislocation, or beginning of this dislocation, or this dislocation can simply, this atom can hop over here. Now, it effectively, dislocation is what we call climb. Okay? So you need vacancies to eat up in order for dislocations to move, to climb, to move perpendicular to its Burgers vector. And so if, yeah. But they can glide very freely, so there's some, just some time scale for, you know, some hopping matrix element. If you have a dislocation here, it can move freely along the Burgers vector. All it does is simply, you know, you simply exchange this bond and put it over here. Have this bond hop over to here, and now you hopped over. Okay, so in fact, if you take a crystal and you apply a strain, shear strain, that's a dislocations will move across the crystal. So these dislocations are subdimensional particles. So this property was well known. In fact, you know, at finite temperatures, of course, you always have vacancy interstitials, but the diffusion coefficients for dislocations are very different, perpendicular and parallel to the Burgers vector.
So in the climb, what happened to the vacancy? I mean, the whole lattice has expanded a little bit or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. But it's not a topological thing. It just, yeah, so you have a little bit of volume change. Okay, so in fact, I mean, very, as soon as I appreciated this, I kind of worked out a, like a baby classical duality of this. So you start out with elasticity theory. Uij is a strain tensor. So it's kind of simplest theory of it, like isotropic elasticity is just Uij squared, just for simplicity. And if you dualize it, which means you describe it in terms of topological defects. What you get is a theory that looks like this. You have some what's called the Airy stress function, whose elasticity is a Laplacian elasticity, right, rather than a gradient. And then that Airy stress function couples to topological defects. S is the disclination, so it couples like a, the way a scalar potential would couple to charge. And then it also couples to a curl of B, curl of the Burgers vector, and that's like, you know, that just captures this physics. If you have a curl of a Burgers vector, that's also disclinicity charge. Okay, and so that's just captured here. There's a non-trivial curl of Burgers vector here. That's because Burgers vectors end. So that's kind of, you can think of it as like a classical baby gauge theory in terms of the scalar potential. But the, you know, so this is, you know, at least description of elasticity in terms of Airy stress function is, you know, a couple of centuries old.
How is pi related to Uij? How do you go from one?
So you will see that when I do the real thing, but it's basically the way the vector potential is related to electrical magnetic fields. So it's like a, you know, double gradient of phi. So when you write down equation of motion of this for that Hamiltonian, that equation of motion will simply say that the stress is divergentless. Okay, that's just basically Newton's equation. Okay, there's no stress. So how do you solve that equation? That's, think of that as an analog of divergence of B is zero. How do you solve that? You say, well, stress is a curl of some scalar, double curl of some scalar. So it's very much like in electromagnetism, conventional duality, except here there's an extra index. And so you will see that. So yeah, that's how phi appears. It solves a constrained equation. Okay, so just to recap, there's various lattice models, beautiful lattice models, the original, you know, Haas code, you know, the X cube model. Then there's all kinds of coupled layers constructions. Much of this is coming out of Boulder, which has become somewhat of a mecca of fractal physics, with Han Ma sitting in the back is at the center of it, along with Michael Pretko and Mike Kermely. They've been really generating a lot of beautiful work on the subject. Then there's a couple chain construction out of Santa Barbara. There's a parton construction. But the kind of the description that I will focus on, it's a description of a certain class of fractal models, is the higher rank gauge theory. So it's a gauge theory in terms of electromagnetic and magnetic fields, but the electric fields and magnetic fields, the electric fields are second rank tensors rather than vectors, like EIJ. And the Gauss's law is a double divergence equals to the fractal charge. Okay. And this is something that was first appreciated by Michael Pretko, that these higher rank gauge theories are actually in disguise as sort of exhibit fractal phenomena, by which I mean they have excitations that are immobile. But these tensor higher rank gauge theories were actually quite old. You know, they've been studied in high energy community, although I'm not very familiar with that, but they were also picked up and explored by Senka Xu at UCSB, already going back to 2006. So there are, if you want to learn about them, you can look in these set of references. So these are U1 symmetric tensor gauge theories, and they can be formulated as lattice rotor models. But what was not appreciated, even with all these studies of these tensor gauge theories, and that was first appreciated by Michael Pretko in 2016, is that these gauge theories have fractal phenomena. And so, and the reason they do, as I will discuss in more detail, but just let me summarize this, is that there's because of this double divergence, Gauss's law rather than single divergence, they not only conserve charge, fractal charge, they also conserve dipoles. So there's a conservation of charges, but also of dipoles. And that immediately leads to fractal phenomena. That's sort of, that's the brilliant insight that Michael Pretko had. So how does that happen? So suppose you want to move a charge If you want to move a charge, to move a charge, you have to create a dipole. That's really the bottom line. And you cannot create dipole because if you didn't have a dipole, dipoles are conserved, so you can't just create out of the blue, unlike an ordinary electrodynamics. So that's really brilliant and beautiful, kind of a way, very minimalistic way to summarize fracton phenomena. So here's your fracton, let's say you want to move it. Well, if to move it from here to here, you can think of that motion as just adding a dipole with appropriate orientation. You add a plus and minus, this minus cancels this plus, so that would move it back. But, you know, where are you going to get this dipole? It's conserved. If you had a soup of these dipoles, then all of a sudden fractons can move. So, yeah, so the fracton motion is forbidden. On the other hand, dipole motion is not forbidden, but it's constrained. And one can understand that constraint from gauge theory. But actually, the simplest way to understand it is, as I already showed or alluded to, is in terms of these dipoles are going to be the dislocations of the lattice theory. And I already explained to you why dislocations cannot climb, but they can glide. Yeah?
What type of statistics these fractions have? Is it a billion? Or your argument can be also extended to non-abelian?
Yeah, so there's some work trying to extend it in Boulder, actually, and trying to extend it to non-abelian statistics. So everything here is bosonic.
Wait, how can you grade things if you can only move them in one direction?
How can you what?
Grade excitations.
Well, okay, so for these... Well, you can still talk about, let's say, you can braid them on the plane, let's say. Okay. So, yeah, so these tensor gauge theories, there are various kinds. They depend a little bit on what kind of a charges you have, whether you have vector charges or scalar charges. So I'm going to focus on scalar charge U1 symmetric tensor gauge theory. So they look like this. They have an electric field. They have a magnetic field. This is in 2 plus 1 dimension. The magnetic field is a vector. The electric field is a rank 2 symmetric tensor. These are canonic. This is a Hamiltonian formulation. So these guys are canonically conjugate to a vector potential, where this vector potential solves Gauss's law. And the magnetic field is just a funny curl on one of the indices of the symmetric rank 2 gauge field AIJ. You take the curl.
You're at 2 plus 1 or 3 plus 1?
2 plus 1. So I'm going to focus on 2 plus 1 because that's where connection to it connects to the simplest version of elasticity.
I thought fracton models only appeared in 3 dimensions.
No, so these models exist in 2 plus 1 dimension. And the difference is, so any proof of non-existence of fractons below 3 dimensions, this relies on this, those being Z2 gauge theories or Z2 theories. Mm-hmm. This is a U1 version, and so there's nothing that forbids them. You know, so
not susceptible to confinement, or
these are non-compact gauge theory. They're going to end up mapping onto non-compact gauge theory.
Well, but then how do you get them from a lattice spin model?
Okay, so. So there's work on that, and you can try to gauge, you can Higgs the U1 tensor gauge theory to try to get to the Z2 gauge theory, or Z2 models. And this is something that was done by Han and Mike Hermley. So the U1, there's nothing, there's no argument against existence of U1 fracton models in 2 plus 1 dimension. And
maybe, you know, not in these rotor models, but if a lattice spin model with finite Hilbert spaces, maybe there is.
So I'm focusing on a different aspect of it. So for me, these fracton models will emerge from elasticity, 2 plus 1 dimensional elasticity. There, if I don't break translational invariance explicitly, there are no instances on these. It's going to be it'll map onto non-compact U1 tensor gauge theory. So there's no issues there. Okay.
Excuse me, if suppose that we have some lattice model, infinite dimension, finite dimension, is this model topological order? If lattice model exactly corresponds to this phenomenology?
I don't know. Topologically ordered in the sense of having degeneracy on the torus or something like this. Yeah, I think it is, but I don't know how to. I don't have a good characterization.
So there is no symmetry imposed in this theory.
No symmetry imposed. Yeah. In the underlying lattice model in the elasticity, there's translation invariance, which translates into excluding making this a non-compact gauge theory. Okay, so this is an example of a gauge theory that exhibits fracton phenomena. So it's a Gauss's law, scalar double divergence Gauss's law, gauge symmetry, gauge freedom is translation by a double gradient of a scalar. For this scalar charge gauge theory, there are two gauge modes, which are linear, dispersed linearly. And there's other generalizations like vector charge gauge theories that you can read about in Michael's work and also even earlier Shankar Shu's work. So let me now talk about duality. How is this connected to elasticity? So we wanted to show this explicitly, sort of having a full dynamical version of what I showed you, the duality that I alluded to in the very beginning. So first, there's a charge conservation. You know, so you integrate charge over a region, and because of using Gauss's law, that's a boundary. So this is a boundary term. You can integrate to the boundary, so charge is conserved. The only way you can change that is have flux enter through the boundary, and so total charge only changes by particle entering leaving the system. But because this, and so if you had ordinary gauge theory, this would be the end of it. You'd have charge conservation, but not dipole conservation. But because this is a double divergence, actually dipoles are also conserved. The total dipole in some region, which is just the charge times xi, is conserved. And that's because of these two derivatives. And so it can be integrated to the boundary, so dipoles are also conserved. Okay, so now let me switch gears and remind you about elasticity. This audience is quite diverse. So you have in the Eulerian description, you have an atom. Its perfect position, a lattice position is in capital R, but the actual position can be described in terms of a displacement, phonon displacement, U of R, of little r. So U is going to be the dynamical degree of freedom. That's the phonon. Along with that, you have a symmetrized strain, Eulerian strain, which is, you can think of it as a difference between the metric pullback of the flat metric minus the flat metric. Pullback of the flat metric of the embedding space onto your lattice, that's this guy, that's the metric, minus the flat metric. So the strain is just a measure of how different is that pullback metric, distorted metric, difference between that and the flat metric. So in the linearized elasticity, really this is a nonlinear strain in terms of phonons, but the linearized version of it is just a symmetrized derivative of U, of the phonon. And the Hamiltonian is just very simple. It's just P squared over 2m, kinetic energy, plus the elastic energy. That's all it is. So that's all over the elasticity. And if it's, where CIJKL are just the elastic constants of your crystal, and different crystals of different symmetries have different elastic constants. So this is just some constant that you don't have to worry about. In the simplest case of isotropic elasticity, hexagonal lattice, triangular lattice, you just have two elastic constants. This guy is basically two sets of Kronecker deltas with the coefficients mu, which is the shear modulus, and lambda, which is the other Lamé coefficient, which is related to the bulk modulus. Some combination of these is a bulk modulus. So so there's two modes of distortion. There's a divergence distortion, where you actually change the local density of the lattice, and there's a shear distortion, Uij. Okay, so that's it. That's the Hamiltonian, that's the elasticity. And the topological defects are a statement about non-trivial singular deformations of this phonon. So really, you only have is atoms. So this phonon description, single-valued phonon displacement, is not enough to describe all the excitations. The smooth excitations of the phonons, but you also have topological defects. So one topological defect is the disclination. It's a non-trivial curl of a gradient of theta, where theta is the bond angle. And bond angle, you can think of as the anti-symmetric part. I shouldn't have really written it this way, but it's the if you take the unsymmetrized strain, di uj, and take its anti-symmetric part, that's the bond angle. It describes the local orientation of the bonds. So non-trivial curl of that gradient of that bond angle, that's the disclination density. So if you have a five-fold coordinated spot or a seven-fold coordinated spot in the otherwise hexagonal lattice, then when you go around, as indicated here, when you go around and track the bond angle, you go around in a circle, in real space, your bond angle will rotate by the one of the angles, 2 pi over 6, or minus 2 pi over 6, depending on whether you have a five-fold coordinated spot, that's a disclination charge, or seven-fold coordinated spot. Okay. And the other defect is a disclination. It's a non-trivial curl of a gradient of the displacement field of the phonon. And that's and since the phonon is a vector, the charge is a vector charge. That's the Burgers vector. And again, if you go around this dislocation, you'll have a displacement, a non-trivial displacement, even though you've gone around in a circle. And there are, you know, less topological objects like vacancy statisticials. These are just missing atoms. So it's sort of like locally you have a change in the density, in local density. So those are degrees of freedom of a crystal. And so now what we want to do is relate the two things I talked about, these tensor gauge theories and elasticity. So I think it's pretty obvious how it's related. But before I do that, if you're not familiar with this, let me remind you how it goes for the most basic dualities that we take advantage of in condensed matter physics, so-called boson-vortex duality. So it's a duality between a superfluid and a Maxwell gauge theory, vector gauge theory. So in a superfluid, you have a long-range superfluid order. Bosons exhibit off-diagonal long-range order. And the Goldstone modes is the phase, local phase, of the superfluid order parameter. So, but in addition to this Goldstone mode phi, there are singular deformations of the Goldstone mode phi which have non-trivial curl of the gradient. So they have non-trivial circulation of the superfluid order parameter, of the phase of the superfluid order parameter. They correspond to the currents, circulating currents, and those are the vortices. So they're there are singular deformations of phi of the phase of the superfluid order parameter whose curl of the gradient is non-trivial, and that curl of the gradient is just the vortex density. Okay, but so if you stare at this for a second, if you just simply define a 90 degree rotated current, so the current is the gradient of phi. If you define a current which is 90 degree rotated to that vector, to that current, call that the electric field, then this guy just becomes a divergence of that fake electric field, and so it becomes Gauss's law. So this thing just looks like Gauss's law for the electric field that's 90 degree rotated from the currents, from the circulation. So that's the beginnings of this duality. And then the Hamiltonian is of the superfluid is just, or an insulator, but let's focus on superfluid. There's some charging term or the interaction term between the bosons. That's just density squared. And then there's a kinetic energy term, which is just a gradient of phi. That's current squared. So there's kinetic energy, potential energy. But, you know, that's just a harmonic oscillator in terms of the two canonically conjugate variables, phi and n. And those, under this change, just map onto ordinary electrodynamics in 2 plus 1 dimension, where magnetic field is just the charge density. boson charge density. So n squared is just b squared, and gradient of phi squared is just e squared. It's very, very beautiful and very simple. It goes back to Descoupton and Halpern, Fisher and Lee, and even before anticipated by Peskin, I believe. Okay, so that's how you have, on one hand, local description, symmetry breaking description. On the other hand, you have a photon description of the same thing. So we want to do the same thing here. And in retrospect, it's very simple. There's just one extra index. This gradient of phi squared, well, imagine phi now has been replaced by a vector ui, which is the phonon. So it's just kind of like an extra index comes along. You're just going to just track through those indices. But otherwise, it's very, very similar. So here's your elasticity. And I wrote in the Lagrangian language, kinetic energy, velocity of atoms, or velocity of, you know, the phonon dynamics plus the elasticity. What you do is it's just convenient to decouple this guy into its kind of into its canonically conjugate variable, which is the stress. Think of it as just the Hubbard-Sartorovich transformation. I went from uij squared to sigma ij squared plus the sigma times the uij strain tensor. Here it is. Okay, so I just decoupled it. So think of this as like the canonically conjugate. This is like the Hamiltonian, and this is like the coupling pq dot term. In the same way that you have a p squared times plus p times q dot, or u dot. So in this formulation, it's very then easy to execute this duality, to demonstrate this duality. What you do is you break up the phonon displacement into smooth part and a singular part. The smooth part, if you integrate over the smooth part, it gives you the singular part, double curl of the singular part can be non-trivial, that's why it's singular, and that the right-hand side encodes disclination density. Okay. But if you integrate out in the path integral over the smooth part, you can see here, you just integrate by parts, that encodes divergence of sigma ij. And if you integrate here by parts, you get time derivative of momentum, pi. So that together encodes a constraint. That constraint is just Newton's law. Time derivative of momentum minus the gradient of the stress is zero. You can think of it as just a continuity equation for momentum. So that's just Newton's law. But as I described for the ordinary duality, you can just look at this and rewrite this as double divergence of the electric field, where the electric field is 90-degree rotation on both indices by these epsilon symbols of the strain tensor. So this just looks like double divergence equals to something. That's the fracton double divergence Gauss's law. So now I know what my electric field is. And so this is what I said. So that's one statement. That's what happens to the Gauss's law, or to this disclination density. But also, if you look at this equation, if you define magnetic field as a 90-degree rotated momentum, and the electric field is a 90-degree rotated stress, then this equation just becomes Faraday's law. So Newton's law is just maps onto Faraday's law. Time derivative magnetic field is a curl of the funny curl of the tensor gauge field, electric field. Okay? And so the gauge fields are, so if you want to solve this, just like an ordinary E&M, you want to solve this constraint, the way you solve it is just say B is a curl of A, and electric field is some other kind of a curl, which is time derivative of Aij minus double derivative of the scalar potential. And then that introduces this gauge freedom. So that's it. So just to summarize, you have an elastic Lagrangian, you have some Coulomb, you have a constraint on the topological defects of your lattice, but then under this transformation, you end up getting vector potentials, tensor vector potential, symmetric tensor vector potential Aij that produces for you electric and magnetic fields. These guys are canonically conjugate. Here's your Hamiltonian, e squared plus b squared with the appropriate indices. And there's a scalar potential, which was the airy stress function that I mentioned before, that couples to the fracton charge. And then Aij couples to the fracton current. You can ask, what is this fracton current? It's this time, mixed time and spatial derivative of the phonon displacement. And so what that current is actually this funny object. It's the 90 degree rotated Burgers vector times the velocity. That's what it is locally. So it's the current. It's a two tensor object because it tells you about the motion of dislocations. It's the current of dislocations. Normally, current is a vector. This current is a tensor because it's carrying Burgers vector, which is a vector itself. And so here's the continuity equation for the, here's Gauss's law, a continuity equation for the dislocation current, and related to time derivative of the dislocation charge or the fracton charge. If you differentiate this Hamiltonian with respect to this vector potential, you get, in addition to the Faraday's law, you now get the Ampere's law. So the physical content of this, if you look at the, was, you know, goes back to my work with Christina Marchetti in 1998, where we was trying to melt vortex lattices and superconductor by unbinding dislocation loops and disclination loops. And there, this beautiful equation, if I do say so myself, emerges where we were considering vacancies, interstitials, and dislocation currents. And so if you look at the trace part of this generalized Ampere's law, you discover a very beautiful equation. It says that time derivative of the of the vacancies interstitial density plus a divergence of the vacancies interstitial density is no longer conserved. It equals to the trace of this current. And so what that says is, it says if, well, if you look at what this trace of this current is, it's actually just a cross product between velocity and the Burgers vector. So it says that if you have a velocity of a Burgers vector, of a dislocation that's perpendicular to the Burgers vector, you'll have non-zero trace, and that's exactly the climb. So it says that if dislocations climb, they violate conservation of vacancy interstitials. So if you force a dislocation to climb, they will leave behind vacancies interstitials. Their source of their motion perpendicular to Burgers vector is a source of vacancies interstitial. So that's the physical content of this Ampere's law. Yeah?
So A is a two-form?
No, it's not a two-form. It's a symmetric tensor.
It transforms with two derivatives.
It's but it's a symmetric. It's a symmetric tensor. It's not a two-form. Two-form is it would be intersymmetric. So when you generalize this to three dimensions, three plus one dimensions, as was done recently by Pai and Michael Pretko, then you get a theory in which you have both symmetric tensors and antisymmetric tensors, two forms. So then you get two forms. But this is different. This is purely symmetric tensor. There's another question.
I know. I was going to ask why you couldn't generalize to three plus one.
Yeah. So it has been now generalized.
Can I ask a question? So can you go back one slide? I'm confused by Jij because on the one hand, it appears in Ampere's law as a current, but just with two indices.
Say it again here?
Yeah, in Ampere's law.
Okay.
Yes, on the other hand, in the conservation equation, in the continuity equation, it appears with two derivatives rather than one. So...
In here, you mean?
Yes, so it doesn't behave like a usual current, no? I guess what I'm saying is that in the continuity equation, the real current is dj of Jij.
That's different, you know, so this is more constraining. Dj of Jij is more constraining than just some, you know,
yes,
than just some vector current, which obeys current equation. It, for example, the curl of that, of my dj, Jij, is zero, but yours will not be. So there's a version of this which is a vector charge tensor gauge theory, which again you can read about in Shankar Shu's work and Michael Pretko's work. Those will have a vector current rather than a tensor current. So to summarize, here's the whole talk in retrospect. So the fracton gauge theory, tensor gauge theory, U1 description of the U1 fracton matter has, you know, Gauss's law, which maps onto just the disclination charge. So fractons mapped onto disclinations. Dipoles of fractons map onto dislocations, which are the dipoles of disclinations. Gauge modes are like phonons. Electric field is like strain or stress. Magnetic field is like the lattice momentum. And Faraday's law and Newton's law have a correspondence between them.
What are vacancies on the left-hand side?
Say it again?
Vacancies and interstitials, what are they?
They're like quadrupoles. They're pairs of dipoles. So they're quadrupole defects, and they're not conserved, so they're there, but you know, they're not topological. So, you know, what good is this? Well, it kind of demystifies at least this class of fracton theories, but it also, you can then, we know so much about elasticity and melting and in statistical mechanics, and we understand crystals quite well, so then perhaps you can learn some things about fracton matter and maybe in the other direction. So for example, I wasn't aware of, and it's, you know, and I work on elasticity, so although since then we found some old references which do point this out, that disclinations cannot move. But so, you know, thinking about fracton matter reminded us, and is a very minimal formulation of immobility of disclination. But for, just to give you some taste of it, so how do you, you can think about melting, for example. So if you have a crystal, in two dimensions, there's a beautiful theory building on Costello-Stallus by Halper, Nelson, and Young, and Berezinski before that, thinking about these kind of ideas. The way a crystal melts, a crystal can melt in a continuous way, and it does it by unbinding or condensing dislocations. When you unbind and condense dislocations, you lose elasticity, you lose your shear modulus, and what you get is a fluid. But that fluid is not just an isotropic fluid, it still has orientational order, so it's a liquid crystal. It's a hexadic, what we call a hexadic. So it's a fluid that flows, but it has a local orientation. It's like a bunch of particles with a little hexagons attached to them. Hexagons are randomly located, but they have correlations in their orientation. That's what a hexadic is. But then when you unbind disclinations in the hexadic, you get an ordinary liquid. So that's a very famous theory that goes back to late 70s. But then you can use this to then think about fracton matter and and phase transitions out of fracton matter. So if you have a fracton insulator, you can unbind condensed dipoles, and you'll get dipole condensate, which is no longer fracton. And then you get if you unbind fractons, you get an ordinary fluid.
So is that really temperature that exists now?
So here it's a temperature, so it's a classical transition. It's just really just transcribing things that you know here, except what's nice is there's a, so this, I've never seen this described, but there's a nice Sine-Gordon-like description of it, and I find it very beautiful. There's a two cosine terms, one for disclinations, which is an ordinary cosine, but then there's one for dislocations, which is a rotated gradient of phi, coupled to the three cosines for the three Burgers vector, dotted into the Burgers vector. This guy is always irrelevant in the crystal phase. So the first thing that happens is this guy can become relevant. When this guy becomes relevant, this guy becomes massive, this field, and that you can then ignore this, and then that allows this guy to become relevant or irrelevant. So there's a very minimalist and very simple description of this two-stage melting transition of a two-dimensional crystal, and therefore of the fracton crystal, of the fracton state. So that's a classical transition, but
you're saying the fracton states will have finite temperature phase transition.
That's right. But so now we went back. So this, I have said nothing about statistics of the actual atoms. So this is, if you wish, I had an incomplete description so far. So now I want to go back and clean this up a little bit. So I want to say, okay, I need to make a statement about statistics of the actual atoms from which the crystal is made up of. And so let me think about a bosonic crystal. Okay. And so if you think about bosonic crystal, then there's actually additional phenomena going on with this fractal phenomena, those bosons themselves can both condense or not. So it's sort of like you now have in parallel two things going on. You have the vector, you have the boson vortex duality going on in principle, and you have this fracton physics going on, the elasticity physics. It's sort of like two XY models, the elasticity XY model and the off-diagonal long-range order XY model. And so what if you push that through, what you get is a hybrid U1 vector tensor gauge duality. And this is so I talked about both. I talked independently about when I was introducing duality, I was talking about vector gauge duality. That's the ordinary electrodynamics. And then I talked about tensor gauge duality. That's this fracton electrodynamics. And so what you get is kind of a sum of these two. So here's the fracton Hamiltonian, fracton gauge theory. Then you get the ordinary electrodynamics, E squared plus B squared, corresponding to the off-diagonal Langer, you know, description of the superfluid. And then they both have these gauge fields coupled to the currents in this way. But then you also have a coupling, which is kind of like the mutual axion electrodynamics, the electric field of the vector of the bosons couples to the magnetic field of the tensor gauge theory, and the magnetic field of the vector duality couples to the trace of the electric tensor gauge electric field, tensor electric field. So you get this mutual axion electrodynamics. So what does this buy you? It reminds you that you have another two fracton phases, actually. You can have a fracton phase, which is the analog of a supersolid. That's a fracton phase in which you have crystalline order, you have elasticity, you have fracton phenomena, but vacant interstitials have proliferated in the ground state. So you can think of it as like an incommensurate crystal in which, in addition to the phonons, you have vacant interstitials. And those vacant interstitials being bosons, they have both condensed in the ground state. So it's a superfluid crystal, hence supersolid. So that's a fracton superfluid. So there, okay, and let me talk about this one. On the other hand, if you don't, you know, if those bosons are in the mod-insulating state, meaning in the vacuum they're gapped, then you have what I talked about. It's really what I talked about so far is really fracton mod-insulator. And in the fracton mod insulator, U1 charge conservation symmetry is not broken. So because of that, dislocations or dipoles are confined to a plane, or they can't move perpendicular to the Burgers vector. But in this fracton superfluid phase, in the supersolid phase, you break U1 charge conservation symmetry. In a simple language, if you have vacancy interstitials all around, they are both condensed. So now, the dipoles can move. They don't have this subdimensional dynamics. So what does that mean? That means in this theory, when you condense vortices, when you condense these charges, the fracton dipole dimensional, so basically when you condense them, when vortices are not condensed, your dipoles are not subdimensional particles, but condensation of vortices confines the dipoles to a lower dimensional space. So superfluid to mod-insulating fracton transition is a confinement, subdimensional confinement transition for the dipoles. Let me just, yep.
Do you have a microscopic picture of the E.V couplings?
I don't. At the moment, I don't understand. We have not explored, and we're trying to think about what is the consequence, if there are any interesting consequences of it. In the elasticity language, as always, it's very simple. It just says, these couplings are very simple. So it just basically says that if you have think of electric field, the little e is just the current of bosons. When the bosons flow, they drag the lattice along. So this is just the momentum of the lattice coupling to the current of the bosons, of the vacancy interstitials. And what is this? This is, again, very trivial. It just looks sophisticated in the gauge theory language. It just means if I have some increased density of bosons in some region, I'm going to compress the lattice. EII is like the UII. Okay, you just train it a little bit. That's all it means. Yeah, so now if that's what you mean, yeah, that we understand very well. Okay, so anyway, so I'm running, you know, I started a little late, but so I'm right on time. But basically, you know, you can read through this. There's a lot of interesting and tantalizing sort of looks to the future of what to do with this. But just to summarize is the line in the bullet in the blue, you know, there's this quite mystifying fractal phenomena which is demystified by mapping it to a crystal and to elasticity, something much more familiar. And we hope to utilize this in both directions to inform both subfields, if you wish. But with that, I'll stop and thank you for your attention. Well, so if you don't have, I mean, I can just repeat what I said. So if you don't have if on the elasticity side and the crystal side, symmetry, translational symmetry and rotational symmetry are broken spontaneously, the gauge theory that it maps onto is a non-compact gauge theory. So it doesn't have instantons. But if you introduce a lattice, if you introduce a substrate, then now your momentum is no longer conserved on the elasticity side. So that maps onto allowing monopoles or instantons, you know, monopoles in space-time in the gauge theory that this maps onto. It's because the magnetic field of this tensor gauge theory is just the momentum, finely rotated momentum of the lattice. So if the momentum is conserved, flux is conserved. You cannot, you don't have monopole.
And from the experimental perspective, I'm wondering, can we do experiments on quantum crystals now where we learn something about fractons that we didn't know before? Is there anything you can think of?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Short answer is I don't know right now. I don't have anything deep to say. It's kind of like this connection, at least for these U1 fractal theories, kind of demystifies it. You know, you're not going to, you know, everything you know about elasticity and crystals and topological defects, well, you just use this mapping, and you know, you can now write a Nature paper saying, you know, you have realized the fractal matter and you know, and you have perfect quantum memory, et cetera, but all you're saying in the mapped language is that, okay, disclinations don't move, dislocations are confined to lines. That's what you'd be saying. So it's kind of, you know, if you wish, simple and kind of. But the mapping is the power that gives you that. Yeah.
Why doesn't this model have finite phase transition temperature, whereas the original model did not have?
I believe these U1 fractal gauge theories have a finite temperature.
Yeah, but if I think about like Q state version, usually if I increase the number of states, like Q to some reasonably big number of finite, we can see some U1 physics, like Q state clock model. So, but for any finite dimensional system, I think there is no finite phase transition, temperature phase transition. So I'm wondering why in this case.
Yeah, that's, I mean, maybe it's a fundamental difference between U1, I guess, and a discrete gauge theory.
What's the order parameter, the velocity button?
For this transition?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a topological transition, so there's no order parameter. I mean, well, it's a condensate of this. It's a condensate of dislocations and a condensate of disclinations. So if you dualize it, it looks like a funny superconductor in which there's a Higgs transition. So it's not a symmetry breaking transition, but there's a Higgs transition. When you go to a superconducting state, that's of that dual superconductor, that's condensate of dislocations. That matter field that's condensed is either dislocations or disclinations. And that gaps out your gauge fields, and that is what gives you a liquid, and liquid doesn't have Goldstone modes, doesn't have the phonons.
Oh, yes. Actually, I'm a bit confused. So in the original model,
mm-hmm.
or like some version of the model which would correspond to this, it's lattice systems, and then the lattice structure is fixed, and then they're out. So like it's, but in this description, we have like dislocations and so on. How are these things are related? Like putting like excitation in the original lattice model can be viewed as like change of the lattice structure.
So Shankishu has this rotor description, you know, sort of these rotor tensor fields live on the lattice. And so it looks like a funny rotor model. So then it looks like an internal symmetry. A topological, these dislocations, lattice is fixed, and you have some internal symmetry that has topological defects in that symmetry, like, you know, really fluxes in that, in those rotors, in the phases of those rotors.
So these things carry UIJ.
Right. That's right. Yeah, so there, in that description, geometry is decoupled from these rotors. While for me, the geometry is the rotors. So it's, you know, it's a funny description because I start out with these Goldstone modes, which themselves describe the geometry, but they depend on geometry.
Yeah, so we can continue the discussion. That'll be great.